The Trump administration has revealed a number of new details about U.S. airstrikes on Iran's nuclear program.
The president's top military advisor described an operation many years in the making. And at the end of those years, he said B-2 pilots put giant bombs on the target and returned safely. At the same briefing, the defense secretary attacked the media, but officials did not give much clarity on exactly how much damage the attack did to Iran's nuclear program.
For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, so are we any closer at all to knowing how much damage was done to Iran's nuclear program?
Well, we're learning more, but we still don't have a clear assessment. And it's probably not realistic to expect one at this point. All the evidence presented by the Trump administration shows the U.S. airstrikes hit their target Sunday at three separate nuclear sites south of Iran's capital, Tehran. But President Trump just got way out ahead of everyone by immediately saying the Iranian program was completely wiped out. There just doesn't appear to be enough intelligence yet to make such a definitive statement. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe briefed senators on Capitol Hill Thursday. A number of senators emerged and said it's just too early to tell the full extent of the damage.
And there was also that Pentagon briefing that Steve mentioned earlier, Greg, where we heard about how long the U.S. Has been tracking developments at the most important nuclear site, Fordos. Tell us about the briefing.
Yeah, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, said the U.S. detected Iran's work on the mountain in Fordo early on. So way back in 2009, the military selected a couple officers with the Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency to work on this full time.
For more than 15 years, this officer and his teammate lived and breathed this single target, Fordo. He watched the Iranians dig it out. He watched the construction, the weather, the discard material, the geology, every nook, every crater. They literally dreamed about this target at night when they slept.
And this was extremely sensitive and secretive work. They couldn't discuss it with family or friends. They just kept grinding away all these years with all the twists and turns involving Iran's nuclear program.
So what problems do they see?
Well, they came to realize the U.S. didn't have a weapon that could reach a target this deep inside a mountain, perhaps 300 feet down. So Kane said they collaborated with munitions experts, and the result was this 30,000-pound bunker-busting bomb known as the Massive Ordnance Penetrator.
They tested it over and over again. They accomplished hundreds of test shots and dropped many full-scale weapons against extremely realistic targets for a single purpose: kill this target at the time and place of our nation's choosing.
And that time and place came Sunday in Iran.
Okay, so it seems like information is trickling in. What are we learning, though?
Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said his country's nuclear facilities suffered serious damage, but he didn't provide details. And Rafael Grossi, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, also said he believes there was significant damage, but he doesn't think the entire nuclear program was destroyed. Now, a big question is the whereabouts of 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Did Iran hide that somewhere before the U.S. attacks? Well, Grossi said Iranian officials told him they did take protective measures for that uranium, which could be used for a bomb eventually.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, eh?
Today is the last day of the Supreme Court term.
Yeah, and the court has been releasing its rulings in many cases. Today, we expect to learn their opinions on the final six, including some of the biggest ones argued this term.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is covering this and is in our studios once again. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Steve.
Okay, the major case we're looking at is on birthright citizenship. It revolves on the meaning of a phrase in the Constitution, a sentence: all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States, the Constitution says. What should we be looking for in the case?
Well, Donald Trump has issued an executive order saying that only some children born in the United States can be citizens. And it's directly opposite of what the actual text says in the Constitution. And every judge to have ruled on it has said he's wrong. It's every baby born in the United States isn't automatically an American citizen. The Justice Department, I think, knowing that it was going to lose this case on the merits, didn't ask the court to reverse those decisions. Instead, it went to court and said, please, Supreme Court, these judges have made their rulings apply nationwide, and that exceeds their authority. We want you to bar these kinds of nationwide injunctions, which, if the court does that, would make litigating against Trump administration policies exponentially more difficult.
Given what you said, that the administration went to the Supreme Court on this narrower question, could the justices rule anyway on the question of birthright citizenship and what it means?
Look, they're the Supreme Court of the United States. They can do what they want. But the question wasn't briefed or argued, and it wasn't discussed in the argument at all.
What are some of the other cases you're watching for?
There's a big case from Montgomery County, Maryland, that tests whether parents are entitled to opt their children out of classes when they object to the school district's curriculum on religious grounds. This was a case involving grade school children and books that had gay and lesbian characters. But you could imagine that it might be in also about teaching Darwin's theory of evolution. So it has a lot of potential for punch, and school officials are pretty nervous about it.
There's something about Obamacare before the court?
Yeah, there's yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act brought by conservative groups. This time, Obamacare's opponents are targeting a measure that requires most private insurance companies to provide free preventive care without copays or deductibles to both adults and children. And there are about 150 million people who benefit from this, and it'll be gone if the court rules with the challengers. Finally, there's also a case challenging a Texas law that seeks to crack down on kids' access to pornography by requiring everyone, including adults, to provide proof of age on the website before they get access.
So once the court rules on these cases, are you and they done for the summer?
Not quite. There are several cases on the shadow docket, otherwise called the emergency docket. These are consequential cases involving layoffs of federal workers, shuttering various agencies, deporting people without due process. So they're going to have to work over the summer, but they'll probably work from very glitzy places.
Got it. Well, Nina, we'll be listening for your coverage later in the day.
Thank you.
NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The U.S. is stepping up its support for a food program in Gaza that the United Nations has described as a death trap.
The Trump administration says it's allocating $30 million for that program. It comes at a moment when chaos is spreading in Gaza, where armed groups are now looting and attacking United Nations aid convoys.
Here to tell us more about this is NPR international correspondent Aya Betraoui in Dubai, and a warning that we will be talking about some graphic details of the violence in Gaza. So I'll start off by just telling us about this plan and why the Trump administration is funding it.
Sure. So this is a plan that began in Gaza exactly a month ago. And it's a plan that Israel devised, and it works like this. A group calling itself the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation uses American contractors to distribute boxes of food in just 4 sites in Gaza. And these 4 sites are drawing thousands of hungry people every day, desperate for food. Now, Gaza's health ministry says hundreds of them have been killed and thousands wounded trying to reach these GHF sites since they began operations. This group, GHF, insists these shootings are not happening near their sites. But here's what State Department Tommy spokesman Tommy Pigott had to say yesterday.
We see the $30 million approved. So that's what the story is here, moving to implement, get those creative solutions in there to make sure that the aid being distributed is not being looted by Hamas.
And he called on other countries to join in funding GHF. But this week, a dozen human rights and legal groups warned that any countries or donors backing GHF are potentially liable for complicity in war crimes.
But why is it so deadly right now to get food there?
You know, partly it's because these GHF sites were put in military zones where Israeli troops are positioned and where Palestinians are not supposed to be. And so people are being shot in these red zones. And Israel's military says it's fired warning shots at crowds approaching troops, clearing them out. The military says it's reviewing and undergoing learning processes like building fences and expanding routes to these sites. But these daily shootings continue. And I want you to have a listen to American physician Dr. Adnan Hossein from Dallas. He's been volunteering in Gaza for the past 2 weeks. He tells me every day he's treating people shot near these GHF sites. He called it a horror movie on repeat.
I can't tell you how many boys, young boys and adults, that get rushed into my resuscitation bay, bleeding out from their abdomen, bleeding out from their head. And when I'm exposing them, trying to look for their injuries, what I find is empty bags that they had only hoped to fill with food just so that they could survive and for a few more days.
And, you know, he sent me photos this week of boys who've lost their eyes and boys who've been paralyzed being shot by Israeli forces near these GHF sites.
Wow, that's difficult to hear. Okay, so this plan by Israel and the U.S. is supposed to keep aid from reaching Hamas, but we're seeing these incidents of looting still happening in Gaza. So who's behind that?
So there's hardly been a trickle of UN aid allowed into Gaza, and most of it's being looted by hungry people and armed clans. Now, Palestinians say 120 aid trucks were stolen by armed clans in southern Gaza in just the past 2 days. Now, this comes as Israel has admitted to arming groups in Gaza to undermine Hamas, groups that are known for looting. But what we're seeing now is even more clans clashing with Hamas security officials who are trying to crack down on this looting and the price gouging of these stolen goods in the markets. Now, one of these clans actually raided Nasser Hospital, where Dr. Hussein and other American doctors volunteer, and opened fire inside yesterday. But we also yesterday saw Hamas security forces being targeted by an Israeli airstrike. The Gaza Health Ministry says 19 people were killed trying to get flour that these security forces had confiscated from the looters and were distributing to a crowd of people. Now, these security forces are under the Interior Ministry, which oversees the police. Israel's military has acknowledged throughout the war targeting police in Gaza, saying they're an arm of Hamas. Hundreds have been killed. But Gaza's police say they're not part of any political or armed wing of Hamas. Ultimately, you know, this chaos and breakdown of order is happening after more than 20 months of war, as Hamas is also losing its grip on the territory.
That's NPR correspondent Taya Batraoui in Dubai. Thank you.
Thank you.